and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP, and specifically we're going to be going into risk acquisition strategy. Right, we got to think about what happens when our network, our organization starts to grow. We start bringing in new hardware. Where do we get that from? What are the security risks associated with that? We start outsourcing to third-party providers. You know, what do we have to think about? And here to help us with all of that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
Good. How's everybody doing today? Hopefully it's a good weather day where you are.
Yeah, not so much
for us, but that's okay. All right, so you know, it's good to talk about risk, and we've talked a lot about risk, and it's good obviously to be aware of risk in many different areas for many different reasons, right? So when we think about risk and we think about acquisition and acquisition strategy and how we manage risk in the supply chain, what we want to do is actually step back for a minute. What we want to really think about first is what are the potential vectors, the potential places where risk may come into the organization. We've talked a lot about threat sources, threat actors, right? Bad actors, people, services, malware, things that are looking to do us harm. We know from our prior episode conversations about risk that this is one of the places, probably the primary place, where we focus on the impact of risk, because we think about threat sources leading to threat events. Threat events ultimately lead to the likelihood that a vulnerability will become exploited, which eventually, depending on what happens and how we deal with that through mitigation, acceptance, transference, and or avoidance of risk, may lead to organizational risk. And we have to then measure, quantify what that risk may look like from an impact perspective. And we have to think about qualitatively measuring what the impact of that risk is in a soft as opposed to a hard way. So we've talked about all this already. What we haven't really linked to this conversation is what some of the potential attacks, the places where we actually see this happening, can occur from. And I think a great way to start talking about acquisition strategies is by looking at places where we may fall prey to or be subject to attack. And being aware of those helps us to frame the conversation about what we look to do when we protect not only the supply chain, but protect the information and the systems that come to us through that outsourcing or reciprocal arrangement when we contract. So if we step back and think about things like social engineering as an attack vector, you know, what does that mean to us? It means typically that people that are going to have information in our organizations may be targeted, right? Somebody may walk up to them and try to ask them questions, seemingly innocently. Hey, I see you've got an IT Pro TV shirt on. I'd point to mine, but I don't have one today, right? But an IT Pro TV shirt, and that must mean you work for them. That's a really cool company. I've heard a little bit about them, but you know, I'm not really sure what you do. Can you tell me a little bit about what IT Pro TV does? That's a pretty seemingly innocent conversation. The reality is, if I'm trying to get information out of you about not just what it is, but more importantly, I work into the conversation at some point. Hey, so where are those studios you talked about? Where are they located, right? And maybe you say, oh yeah, they're you know, at ABC Corp on the corner of Circle Lane and Square Drive, right? And our address is 123 Circle Lane. Okay, I probably didn't need to know that information. You telling me that is probably not a good thing for you. And it's a good thing for me as the potential attacker, because now I have a very useful piece of information. I've got a geographic location, an address as to where I may actually go if I want to physically be able to observe and maybe even attack systems that are located there. Or I have a logical way of figuring out now where those systems are because you've given me the physical location for where the studios are. So a lot of times people are just innocently talking. They're innocently being asked to do something. You know, you see somebody carrying a stack of boxes, right? And they're, you know, kind of wobbling down the road, trying to walk in and get into a building, and everything's falling down. You know, the typical human perspective on that is, right, if you're a nice person, what are you going to do? You're going to go and probably either offer to help them, hey, let me take some of that from you, or at least let me hold the door open for you, because you're clearly not going to be able to get to the door and open it up and do all that. Well, if the door is a security control and it's there as a physical control to prevent unauthorized people from walking in, what if that person doesn't belong there? What if they've just done that effectively to trick somebody into doing the exact thing you're about to do by being a nice person? Carding in and opening the door for them so that they can walk in potentially right under the guise of delivering their boxes. But the reality is now they've effectively gotten past one of the security perimeters. They've breached at least one of the rings in the defense of depth architecture we've built. And again, seemingly innocently, right? I mean, what's the average response? I want to help that person. I want to be nice. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not suggesting you should go through life now forevermore ignoring the plight of people that need help. It's not what being a good information security professional is about. Remember the code of ethics, right? Act honorably, act justly, always make sure you help those that need help. That's important. what I want to point out to you is when we think about something like social engineering, you know, it's the common things that people look to take advantage of that we just don't necessarily stop and think about that can cause us harm. And so I want to think about these kinds of attacks. Things like specifically something like a pretexting attack, which is a form of social engineering attack that effectively allows somebody to pretend to do something in order to gain help or to gain information. You know, I travel a great deal for my work and for what I do. I'm in airports all the time. I'm always in new cities. I'm always spending time with customers in their environments, right? Walking into their buildings, dealing with them in their worlds. And I have to travel a lot to get to those places. I spend inordinately large amounts of time on planes, looking at people violating the most commonsensical rules of information security on a regular basis. People working on proprietary intellectual property, financial documents, legal documents, all sorts of stuff on laptops without glare screens, with no thought really around who's around them in the plane looking at this information. We've made it so easy today to effectively extend the thought process of remote working to traveling because you have internet access, you're comfortable, well, relatively speaking, depending on where you sit in the plane. But in theory, anyway, you've got a seat, you've got a table of some sort. You know, you got lots of time on your hands, depending on the flight, and most people bring their computers, at least if you're traveling on business anyway, right? And so as a result, I see people working all the time. Again, if I was a bad actor, if I was somebody looking to do harm, I wouldn't have to do this anymore, right? I could just decide that I'm going to go out, spend some time on a plane, figure out all the information I need to know about these companies, and I could just put that to use, and I would never have to work again, right? So the reality is, it's very difficult for us to instill in the mind of the end user, the mind of the person that is consuming information and services, even through a contractual agreement, the need for security. And this is really the focus of this conversation. We've talked about phishing attacks already several times in prior episodes. The idea of sending unsolicited email to somebody with a hope of tricking them into clicking on a link or doing something like that in order to respond and give us information. Maybe resetting a username and a password, at least under the guise of doing that anyway, thinking they're submitting that information to IT for support or for reset, but in effect, they're sending it to the hacker who's going to use it to break into a system later. Baiting attacks, where we leave information such as a USB drive sitting on the floor, and then, you know, everybody walks by it, and we wait to see who picks it up and plugs it into a machine. There's a great, really great video out there. If you just Google baiting attacks, as in baiting a hook like phishing, baiting attacks, you'll find several videos out there that people have done just about this concept. You know, kind of a spy camera concept, dropping something on the floor, waiting for people to pick it up, and then seeing what happens. And this happens all the time. I mean, I can, you know, probably on more than one or two hands count the number of times I've done this during pen testing or vulnerability assessments for customers, and almost without exception, every time somebody picks that thing up, takes it in the building, plugs it in, and we figure out how to then, from that point, break into systems because we're able to install malware or install a remote access trojan or whatever's on there that we're using during the test to gain access to a system. So this happens, and it happens quite a bit. Tailgating attacks. I mentioned this and explained this when I said somebody may open the door for you and hold it open while you're walking in. These are different kinds of attacks. We want to make sure we're comfortable with them and we understand what happens with them because our goal is ultimately to reduce security risk. And if we can train people, make them aware of what they need to do, what we call it in the military or in, you know, those kind of circles is operational or situational awareness, right? If you're paying attention to what's going on around you, you're much more likely not to fall prey to things that normally may distract you and may cause you not to pay attention. So if you're focused and you're aware, these are the critical traits we want to try to instill in people through security awareness and training, this is important. How do we translate that out to an acquisition strategy and managing acquisition risk? Well, we have to work with our vendors. We have to think about what kind of information, what kind of system access we're allowing them to have. Most of you listening to our conversations may or may not be familiar specifically with the details of what happened with Target and the Target breach that occurred roughly about 18 months ago now. But if you are generically familiar with the idea behind it, what basically happened is that a vendor using a control system, an HVAC vendor, so basically somebody who was working on heating, electricity, and air conditioning related things in stores, was able to gain access to systems and was given access legitimately to do their job. They had to get into certain systems, be able to do certain things. The problem wasn't the HVAC vendor was a bad actor. The problem was that the system provisioning that took place inside Target through IT to give the vendor access was not managed correctly. And as a result of that, the vendor's access was granted in such a way that they didn't just have access to the HVAC control systems, but they actually had access to other areas of the IT infrastructure. They didn't realize that at the time, and nobody knew that, except, of course, for the bad actors that figured out that they could use that to their advantage. And they were able to get into the back office systems and effectively, as a result, parlay that access that was incorrectly granted, and as a result of that, effectively gain access to systems they never should have seen. That was really what sat at the heart of this issue, and it became a very, very big problem, not only for Target, but for a lot of their customers. Millions of people's account information, credit card numbers, things of that nature were potentially exposed during that breach. This kind of issue is really what we're talking about, this exact thing. How do we reduce the risk profile, or what we call the risk attack surface, right? How do we reduce that, not just for the company, but for everybody that works with us contractually? Because if we're not focused on awareness, if we're not focused on training, if we're not focused on making sure that our vendors are subject to the same security assessments, the same security awareness training requirements, the same vulnerability assessments and penetration testings and audit requirements that we use contractually, we are basically accepting blindly whatever risk they bring into the equation. And we may not realize that they have or don't have the same standards in place that we do. This comes down ultimately to the idea of through contractual negotiations and contractual requirements of mandating that your vendors are going to follow the same standards you do. As a CISSP, one of the key things you have to think about doing is focusing the organization on the management identification, ultimately a management of risk. And we've talked a lot about the ways in which we do that. If you're not able to do that inside the organization, there's no way you're ever going to do it outside the organization. But if you're really good at doing it in the organization, why aren't we extending that thought process to the external vendors and trusted partners that come in through Federation? I mean, that's the logical question. And that's really the thing we got to figure out how to do. So reducing security risks becomes very important. One of the ways we do that is contractually, as I mentioned, through agreements such as service level agreements and stipulating what are called service level requirements that are going to basically build up and stipulate what the building blocks or the necessary items are in the agreement. When you sign a hosting agreement with a company for a cloud service, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, whoever it is, you are being given a list of things you can and cannot do as a customer based on the requirements the vendor has and what they've specified and said to you effectively. In exchange for your money, for us to offer you goods and services, you're going to behave this way, you're going to consume this way, you're going to operate this way. So effectively, you're going to pay attention to our rules and use our system with our rules, effectively. That's what the hosting agreement basically says. And then there's some other stuff in there, certainly about uptime and escalations and things of that nature. If there's a problem, how do I fix a problem? Who do I talk to? What do I do? That stuff's there as well. But the rules of engagement, the rules that stipulate how you're going to consume that service, are very clearly documented in that agreement. There's no reason why you should not be using that same thought process with your vendors to extend that information, that thought process out to them by way of reducing security risk. It becomes very important. And it's one of those things that no matter how many times we talk about, and while it makes great sense on paper and you hear us talk about it and you know, Mike's listening to me and nodding his head going, yeah, that's good stuff. That's exactly what they need to do. Everybody should do that. And that's right. You should. But then we look at the real world and we see time and time again that people don't act with common sense, right? And so while we know it's important, we also realize that it's just not always done, regardless of how much sense it may make. You just don't always do it. We talked a lot in at least one or two other prior episodes about the fact that NIST guidance in particular can be very helpful here, things that may be valuable to you, guidance that may be offered to you. We actually took you out to the NIST website, showed you where to find those documents. There are many of them. NIST 800-61-R2, which is the Computer Security Incident Handling Guide, NIST 800-81-2, Securing DNS. These are just examples of some of the documents that would be valuable as we look at reducing risk and attack surfaces within the organization. 840-R3 or Rev3, Guide to Enterprise Patch Management, another really important one. 882-R1, the Guide to ICS, industrial control systems and how we deal with securing them. That may or may not be something you deal with directly, but if you do, it's a huge, huge area and a very large amount of risk that we have to address in industrial control systems today. 883R1, Guide to Malware Incident Prevention and Handling for Desktops and Laptops. There's probably 20 different NIST guides in that 800 series that are valuable to this conversation. I'm simply throwing out three or four examples. Not indicating in any way, shape, or form, let me be clear, that I expect you to go run out, download those, and read them in order to prepare for the exam. Quite the opposite. This is not an exam about NIST documentation standards. It's an exam about mastering information security knowledge. NIST plays a part in acquisition of that knowledge, but unless you have a need specific to that area, there's no reason to read that documentation right now. There's a great need for you to go out and look at it as you apply the skills that we talk about in any of our episodes across the entire set of discussions we're having to the real world. You want to go do this for real? You need some guidance on how to deal with supply chain risk? Look up the NIST document that helps you to do that. Read it. Implement the guidance you find there. You'll be a lot happier about the outcomes. But we're not suggesting you go study that right now in order to prepare for the exam. Remember, we have to deal with risk across all the areas of the organization. We have to deal with acquisition strategy-related risk across all areas of the organization. Hardware, software, services are typically the areas we focus on. Services typically is where we bring in the external vendors and the contractors, as we were talking about. But hardware and software is a place where we don't always think about that, but we are buying from external sources, right? I mean, unless you are in the habit of building your own software, and some people are, some people develop their own products and services, but even then, you're probably buying hardware. Most of us don't build our own hardware from the ground up. You may buy components and build servers, but you're still buying those chips and those boards from somebody, from some company outside external to your organization. As a result of that, you effectively are opting in to inherit whatever risk that vendor has in their supply chain. You may not realize they have risk, but they do. You know, we've seen examples of it over the years where a vendor has put out a product that for one reason or another was either infected with malware, had been compromised, they weren't aware of it, and it gets out into the market, and then it takes some time for us to realize that, and then we have to deal with remediating the issues associated with that exposure. So it's not as if you just buy equipment and there's never a risk associated with that. I'm not suggesting for a minute that vendors that you buy from regularly are looking to do you harm. I'm just pointing out that you don't know anything about what you're getting from them other than you open the box and there's a circuit board. You open the box and there's a hard drive. Who put the hard drive together, where it came from, what's loaded on there that you may or may not see is something, unfortunately, that we just don't have a lot of visibility into. So being aware of the fact that there's risk in every element of our exchange for goods and services is an important thought process for the CISSP. I don't want you to go hide under a rock either, right? And just say, okay, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. Breathing is too risky. I'm going to stay in bed. You know, that's not the right approach. But what I am suggesting is that we have to be a little bit more skeptical of all the things we take for granted every day. So practical real-world example of this, right? How many of you, if you think about your relationships with the business and the vendors you deal with on a regular basis in your current professional job, right? How many of you are thinking about where you buy your equipment from? How many of you have a policy in place in your organization that stipulates you only buy from what we call OEMs? Original equipment manufacturer vendors. In other words, if you want Dell laptops, you're going to buy directly from Dell or an authorized representative that sells Dell products, right? But you're not going to buy on eBay. You're not going to go out and find something, you know, that is in the, let's just call it the discount channel, right? In the sense that it's refurbished or recycled materials. You may buy refurbished materials directly from the OEM manufacturer, and that's okay because they've dealt with cleaning them up. At least hopefully they've done a good job. But the reality is if you buy a laptop or a server or a router or a switch or, you know, a SAN or a NAS from a third party that's not known to you, effectively a private individual or another company, you're buying whatever the risk is that they've associated with that product, and they haven't clearly articulated or identified what it is. Even if they give you a risk statement and say, okay, Mike, here's the deal. I had malware on this thing. I think I cleaned it up, but I'm just letting you know. I mean, that would be refreshing. That doesn't happen, by the way, right? But that would be refreshing. But, you know, this is basically a problem, right? I mean, we don't have, and I'll make a reference to something you may or may not be familiar with, but we don't have a Carfax service, right, for buying used computer equipment on the internet. I mean, it would be great if we did. Carfax, for those of you that may not know what it is a service that we have in the United States where effectively you're able to go and look up information on a used car that you're about to purchase. And you can see what the history of the used car was, the maintenance cycle on it, if it was dealt with at the dealer, if it was in an accident, most importantly, you're able to get information on the accident, see whether the car was damaged, if so, was it fixed, and how is it fixed. You're effectively able to get a risk report on the vehicle so you know whether it's a good purchase or not. It would be great if we had that. And by the way, I didn't mention this, but I get 10% of any idea that any of you go out and actually figure out how to achieve based on our conversations. Mike gets 5. I get 10, right? Just to be clear. So 15% off the top comes from that idea. But it would be great if we had something like that. I mean, that would be really cool. But we don't, at least not today. Somebody goes out and figures out how to do it, that'd be awesome. But a risk register is a really critical element of what we need, right? I mean, this is really important stuff.
Absolutely. You know, I can't think about the people that are excited. You know, they buy, they need a new router, a new piece of hardware. You go out, you get it from eBay or someplace like that. It comes in, it's like a Christmas present, right? I want to open it up. I want to put it on the network. And there's no thought about, you know, what might already be on there.
And, you know, there may be, you're right, and there may be a thought, right? But the problem is the thought is overwhelmed by the, hey, new toys, shiny new things, right? I want to play with them, as Mike said. That's all good. But the problem is you've just plugged something in that most likely is okay. I mean, let's be honest, more often than not, you don't have a problem. But do you really want to play Russian roulette with your network? Because that's effectively what you're doing, right? You're taking an unknown device, whatever that is, you're plugging it in, and you're hoping that there's nothing evil and nasty lurking on there that's going to jump out to effectively take over your world. And if it does, how are you going to deal with that, right? I mean, those are issues that we really need to think about. You know, being smart is about stopping and really thinking through what the next 5 steps look like and being prepared for the bad and the good that comes with those 5 steps. It's not about plugging it in and then hoping after the fact that nothing goes wrong, right? So it's really about prior planning. That's really what we talk about when we talk about managing risk. It's looking ahead, thinking about your options, assessing what the impact of those decisions are, and then making good decisions. And if you make bad ones, that's okay. But have a plan to deal with them, right? So if you do plug the device in and all of a sudden all the lights dim, right? And you hear a dark, kind of scary voice emanating from the device. Sounds a little bit like Darth Vader, right? Saying, I now own your network, right? Luke, I'm your father, whatever it says. You know, have a plan for that, right? That plan should include quickly exiting the building, right? And then making sure your interns go in to deal with the problem. You shouldn't do that. But you should unplug the device, right? Clearly. First step will be uncable it from the system you just plugged it into so it can't do any more damage. But if we're not thinking ahead and knowing we should do that, how many of us are going to have clarity of mind to think through the fact that the very first thing I should do is make sure that device can't talk to anything else, right? And if you don't plan ahead, I promise you the first thing you're going to do is not to unplug the device, right? You're going to do a lot of other things, but you're not going to unplug the device. So you got to think about this, right? This becomes really important. Making sure we bring in third-party assessment capabilities. We've talked a lot about the value of auditing from outside, the value of penetration testing and vulnerability assessments from outside, that external perspective, right? Make sure you have that perspective brought in. If you're going to contract with a third party, you should have somebody assess their business and do a risk assessment on them before you agree to do business with them. That's becoming more and more acceptable today in business with regards to security and the thought processes around them. Now, I'm not saying that that company is going to think that that's a polite thing for you to do. I'm not suggesting they're going to like being told, hey, we need to have a risk assessment done. But if they want your business, then you guys will work that out. And if you're going to stand firm on that requirement, then hopefully they're going to understand that. And if they don't, then you probably need to find a vendor who will, because they're probably not a good person to partner with, because they're clearly not going to be thinking about risk the same way you do. Because if they are, they're going to understand the value of doing that. And they're probably going to be perfectly fine with it because they know that you're not going to find anything. And it's going to create a level of trust between the two of you that's going to allow you to do more business together. So that's a good thing for both of you, but only if both parties view it the same way. So third-party assessments can be very important and obviously very critical. You know, we talked a little bit about SLAs. I mentioned them a minute or two ago. Service level agreements are also a very useful tool here. Contractually binding both parties to stipulated requirements. Those requirements are called SLRs, service level requirements, to make sure we understand effectively what the rules of engagement are going to be. You know, if Mike and I partner together and say, okay, I'm going to buy goods and services from Mike, Mike's going to provide them to me, I need some agreement with Mike that tells me what I should expect when I pay for my goods and services, and Mike needs some agreement from me as to what I'm going to pay for, and as a result, we both have to understand what our expectations are. And service level agreements are really about defining the agreed upon levels of performance and expectations within that arrangement. It's very important as a contractual vehicle. We use them all the time. There may be external SLAs, and often they are between different vendors and the IT service or function in the business. The business itself may create the SLA with the external company and ask IT to take it on and manage it. There's different ways SLAs may be created. Internal facing SLAs, SLAs that are created between business units and IT within the business, are also common today. We tend to refer to them as OLAs, operational level agreements. They're just internal facing SLAs. They effectively are the same thing for the purposes of our discussion. Just be aware of them, understand what they are. They help us to typically stipulate what minimum acceptable requirements are, both from a performance and in some cases from a security perspective. And identifying minimum requirements is very important. We've talked about requirements gathering and how this works as well. We spent several minutes in one of our, at least one or two of our prior discussions in other episodes, detailing through and walking through the process of how you would do requirements gathering. So making sure we understand how to do requirements gathering, reminding you of that here in this area is also a good thought process for us to be thinking through. We want to also make sure that we're thinking about how we're going to report out on the levels of service and the management of service that we're providing. We've talked a lot about the value of reporting and communicating findings, service level reporting around the implementation of the SLA, the management of risk, the current state of risk becomes important as part of the overall function that we're thinking about as well. And we want to wrap this all up in a pretty bow, right? And really put it together in a way that's going to present it, not just to the organization, but present it to each individual in the organization or in the business in a meaningful and personal way. And this is where security awareness training comes back into the conversation. When we've been thinking about security awareness training, we've really couched that conversation when we've had it with you in terms of, hey, these are good things to tell people about. Make sure they're relevant to their job. Make sure they understand how to engage in that activity. All that's important. But the most important thing we need to do is to figure out what are the messages, right? The things we have to tell the individual users in the business by job role, by area, by function, and then train down on them to make them aware of them. But this is one thing we have to kind of agree on. You're just going to have to trust me on this because I've done this for so many cycles with so many businesses over the years. I can tell you from firsthand experience, this is how it works. If you don't do this on a rolling basis, in other words, if all you do is security awareness training once a year and it becomes an afterthought for most people that they have to check off the box, proverbial literally, by reading through some material, looking at a video, answering some questions, it's like an HR function in effect, right? If that's how you couch it for individuals, it's not very meaningful, right? Oh, that's that whole thing I got to do, right, before the end of the year, got to get that done. And then everybody celebrates, says, yay, we got 95 or 98%. You know, everybody, almost everybody in the company went through it. Awesome. We're good for another year. No, you're really not. All you've done is effectively wasted a half hour of everybody's time in the organization because you haven't really made an impact on them. It's not meaningful. It's not relevant. It's not timely. And it's not helping them do their job better. It's something they don't look forward to. It's something they don't take seriously. And the context and the meaning in the organization is just very irrelevant. It just doesn't really register with people. If you make security awareness training something that happens on a regular basis, continuously in the organization, repurposing and refocusing people's thought process around security, around risk management, around engagement throughout the course of the year, engagement around themed activities or themed messages. There's a million ways to do this. I'm not suggesting you become a party planner. I'm just pointing out that ultimately, security awareness training is more than a simple half-hour video once a year if you want it to be meaningful to your constituents, people you are charged with managing security on behalf of. And as a CISSP, we have to create policies to manage security awareness training. We have to create procedures to implement it. And then we have to manage it throughout the course of the year in the organization. Do more, in other words, than just make it a simple half-hour moment in time. That's a checkbox, and it becomes very relevant to those people that you're trying to reach out and engage with. And as a result, they become much more effective at helping you to manage risk. And that's really what ultimately we want to have happen.
Very good, Adam. We appreciate that. You know, a lot of great information on risk management. And as we start to extend that out beyond our organization, we start bringing in third parties or acquisitions, we've got to see how that changes our risk management and what we need to look for. And we're all looking forward to our next security party. I think it's going to be a blast. I can't wait to see that. You got to make that relevant. As he said, you know, once a year isn't going to cut it. It's got to be something that really does stick with them. And it's got to be a continual thing. Otherwise, it's really not worth doing. All right, Adam, we appreciate that. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to check out one of Adam's live classes, if you want to attend one of his live classes, shoot us an email at cadam@itpro.tv. For now, signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care, everybody.